Okay. So what I'll discuss are regulatory models, in particular in the fly. So first I'll present the result for the fly, and then I'll speak in the time which remains on the evolution of functional modules, so switching a bit to protein complexes, but I guess the basic idea is related to those regulatory models. So let me start right away with the problem of development of the fly. So what the problem is about is very simply explained by this picture and the next one. This is the embryo of the fly. It's about 0.3 millimeters in this direction, 0.1 millimeters in this direction. And this picture is an electron micrograph, which is taken about 3 hours after fertilization. So what you see is essentially no structure. Syncytium just means it's a particular case of development where the embryo is not cellularized yet. So essentially what happens is that this embryo is just made of nuclei, at least at this stage, so material and genetic material can diffuse across the embryo. And the nuclei that you see here are essentially localized on the surface, and here you see the only visible structure at this stage, which is made of what is going to become the germ cells. Well, this is about 3 hours. That's what you see about 15 hours after fertilization. So what you see is essentially that everything is already there. All the segments that will become the segments of the adult body are patterned. And essentially everything is already structured, and this is what will become the head, this is what will become the tail, and this, as I was saying, as the segments and the parasegments, depending on the definition and the nomenclature that you use, which are delineated. So the problem is very simple. How do you go from here, a structure which is already in something which is not structured, to something which is so well structured like this one? And of course there were models which were made based essentially on Turing instabilities, and the story in fact goes quite differently, because there's no instability in the whole system, and in fact the symmetry of the initial embryo is broken by the mother. So what the mother does, in fact, you should imagine that this embryo initially is not in isolation, it's surrounded by follicle cells of the mother, which are injecting genetic material and are providing food to the embryo. So in fact, what the mother does is that it breaks the symmetry, telling essentially by injection of genetic material what the head is and what the tail is. So what the mother does is that it injects what are called morphogens because they define the shape. And this is, for example, the posterior morphogen, which is called nanos. So this is what you see, the concentration of the material at the fertilization time, and this is about what you get sometime after fertilization. So these materials start to diffuse. The law of diffusion is not clear, if it's active diffusion, passive diffusion. Anyhow, what it does is that it goes toward the center of the embryo, creating a gradient which is roughly exponential.
So this is the protein or RNA?
No. So nanos, this one is the protein.
And the blue one is the
as well.
Protein,
yeah.
Early on.
Yes. Nanos, in fact, it's there's no major dynamics going on at the mRNA level, mRNA and protein. There's no translation. There's not big translation control. For the other morphogens, what you have, that you have, for example, so this one was the posterior one. Then you have another posterior one, which is this protein, caudal, and the gradient is in fact created by translational control. So it's injected flat, and then there is the this protein, decoid, which is attaching to mRNA and repressing the translation of caudal, and this is what creates the gradient, which is roughly similar to this one for the caudal protein, while the mRNA is essentially flat. Then you have two morphogens on the anterior side, which is decoid and hatchback. It's not listed here, it's this one. So decoid and hatchback on the anterior side, and then you have a gradient which is going on, which is a bit complicated the way it's formed, but the upshot is that you form a gradient of a protein called dorsal in here. So once you have these gradients laid down by the mother, so the problem of how you break symmetry is done, it's the mother. Then the problem is how do you get from these very broad gradients here to something like this here, where essentially you have defined the identity of single cells. And the way this is done, it's done by a cascade of mostly transcriptional control, and these are the stages which are defined here. So the way the process goes is that most of these guys here, maternal genes, these morphogens, are transcription factors. Transcription factors, so they go and bind to DNA, and once they are attached to DNA, they regulate the rate of expression of the other genes. So you have this class of, this was the mother, this one are zygotic genes, zygotic meaning of the embryo itself. So you have the first layer, gap genes. Gap because essentially when you do genetic, the way all these genes were found is a classical work of Knudsen, Volert, and Eric Vischaus. What they did is that they did the broad genetic screening, so knocking out all the genes and finding out what the phenotype was. And so these gap genes were found, were called gap, because when you do a phenotype study, genetic study like this, the phenotype is that in the embryo you see bands, structures, gap appearing in the structures. So part of the band that you've seen, they completely disappear. So these gap genes, they are controlled by these maternal factors, and the gap genes are coding mostly for, again, transcription factors. So the way the interaction goes is that these guys control these guys. These guys, they talk among each other. And then the ensemble of the two layers control the next layer of expression, which is the per-rule genes. Per-rule because they are expressed in alternating stripes, like even Skip, Fushi, Taratsu, or Harry. And again, these guys here code for transcription factors, controlled by these two here. They talk among each other, and the three layers, they control the last layer, which is the segment polarity genes. Segment polarity because essentially what they do is that they give identity to the segments that were delineated in previous stages. So to resume all this, this is the kind of expression patterns that you get, where the dark here means that there's a concentration, high concentration, and there's nothing in this region here. So hunchback, couple, and hips are gap. These are the per-rules that you'll see. And then the homeotic genes here, the homeotic gene controlling, for example, the identity of the appendages that you give to the various segments. So that's pretty much the, let's say, the phenotypes, the phenomenology of the process. Now, what is going on at the molecular level is more interesting. What goes on is that that's where the modules appear. Okay? Because you might think that all these patterns are controlled at the global level, and in fact that's not quite the case, and what happens is that what is controlling all these expressions are modules. By modules I mean that they are a few hundred stretches of a few hundred bases of DNA, and what they do is that they control the expression by generating elementary patterns. Okay. By elementary patterns, for example, let's take one concrete example here. This is the gene YieldSkip. So it's this gene here, and that's the wild-type expression. You see that's patterned in alternating stripes. So when you look at the DNA around this gene, that's the transcription star, you find these two blocks of roughly 500 bases, which are located downstream, upstream of the gene. This is the sense of transcription. They are located about a few kilobases upstream of the transcription star. And now imagine you do the following experiment. You take out all the rest of the sequence and you just keep a reporter gene, like for example LACZ, which is blue, and then you keep just these 500 bases here and you want to see what happens. Well, what happens is this. All the stripes are gone except the second one. So essentially those 500 bases are by themselves able to drive the expression of one of the stripes. And of course, this other one here, since I put the box there, is responsible for the other two stripes, the stripe 3 and the stripe 7. Okay. So that's where the name modules, cis, and cis just means that they are located in the neighborhood of the gene. So that's what cis is, and modules because they kind of independently are responsible for the expression of the elementary patterns. Now, if you go and look,
I don't actually know about all the modules for Eve.
Yes.
Always hear about 2 and the 3.7.
Right. No. The reason is that the other ones are located downstream. There are 2 more modules which are located a few kilobases downstream of the gene.
In the intron?
No, that one not in the intron. It's really downstream. In the inference, I think it's another gene that I don't recall now, which has a module in the inference. I don't remember which one, but he is downstream. Here it is. Okay. Right, so these are the guys, this is the gene, and this is where they are. Okay. So let's zoom even more and go at the level. You know, now we are zooming. This picture here is a scheme of the 500 bases here. Those 500 bases, we are zooming in and seeing what's going on at the DNA level. Okay, so this picture here is just sketching the concentrations of the factors, transcription factors, which are controlling the expression of the second stripe. So, and in fact, to know what the stripe expression is, you just need to remark that Bicoid and Hatchback are activators, and Giant and Cruple are repressors. So that's enough. You just look at this picture, know that Bicoid and Hatchback are activators, the other two are repressors, and the only place which is left without repressors is this. Yeah, it's this location here where indeed the stripe is localized. Now,
the extreme anterior, right?
The extreme anterior, what happens is that there's another repressor over there that I've not indicated here. But, you know, in this region here, there's repressor, and here there's no repressor, but the concentration is too low, and you're not able to activate any longer. Now, when you look at the DNA level, that's the interesting part that comes in. The interesting part is that if you look at those 500 bases at the DNA, what you discover is that, first of all, you have binding sites, multiple binding sites for the 4 factors. And the other thing that you find is that you see that the competition which is going on between the activators here and the repressors. The way they sense the concentration between each other is that they compete for the same sites here, like for example. And so there's a competition at the level of concentration which is going on between activators and repressors for the same sites. So the picture, the qualitative picture that you get out of here is that you have multiple binding sites for many factors, like 4, easily 4 or even 5. And they compete, they tend to have overlapping sites, which is kind of the nonlinear mechanism which is driving the fact that you can go from these very broad patterns. The nonlinearity is kind of driving you by this nonlinear mechanism, like this one here is clearly a nonlinear mechanism of competition between activators and repressors. This is what is driving the fact that you go from broad patterns to very localized patterns after a while. Now, another remark which should be made is that this problem here is quite different from the problem of spotting binding sites, for example, in bacteria. The reason is that when you look in detail at those binding sites, what you find is that many of them are, in fact, pretty weak. And you can understand that, in fact, the weakness of those binding sites is not accidental. It's not accidental at all, because imagine, for example, just for a second, for the sake of the argument, that Bicoid had an extremely strong binding site. Okay, so one of these Bicoid sites is very strong. Then what happens is that you're not able to sense any longer the concentration of Bicoid. It's going to stick to this, it's going to bind to this binding site here, irrespective of its concentration. So you have completely lost all the sensitivity to the concentration. The process is gone. So this is to say that you have to take into account in this problem the sharing of the competition between binding sites, and you have to account somehow for the strength of the binding sites. That's crucial in the regulatory process. So, this is kind of the introduction to the biological part. Now, the way all this modules were discovered, it's a pretty long and time-consuming process, where essentially what you do is that you take reporter genes, you construct transgenic flies, then you take a few hundred bases, and you check whether those few hundred bases were able to drive the expression of the reporter gene. Then you slide, you move your window up or down of the gene, and every time you check out the way it goes. So this is clearly time-consuming, and it's not very, it's not a very cheap process. So the idea that, is that it's better to try to find out by computer the regions that are good candidates for being models. And in particular, you can see here the rationale of this picture here is to show you that in fact all these modules are extending kilobases. Well, it's not quite clear here, but we're talking about several kilobases. So in fact, the region to scan is made of several kilobases, which clearly for a computer is not a big deal. You can scan the genome, as you will see, in essentially one day you can do the whole genome, but certainly experimentally, already scanning all this region here, it's very time consuming. So that's the motivation for having a method that is able to localize those modules in a fast way. And this is just to show you that in fact it's this competition of binding sites and this aggregation of binding sites, because you will see in a second that what we will look for is an aggregation of binding sites for the transcription factors. So this is just to show you that in fact everybody's showing EVE2, and everybody kinds of talk about EVE2, but it's not just EVE2. I mean, it's really quite a general property, this kind of combinatorial control by several factors sensing the concentration and competing for the same sites with strengths which are variable. And just as a side remark here is to show that it might in fact be that it's not just high eukaryotes that have this kind of process. This is the chromatin immunoprecipitation data for Cerevisiae, and this is the number of genes that have a certain number of regulators here. And as you can see, certainly the majority is made of guys regulated by one gene. I mean, the only caveat in this picture here is that the fact that the transcription factors are sticking doesn't mean that they're regulating. But, you know, modulo this caveat, essentially we might say that whatever is binding is regulating in the first approximation. So what you see is that the majority is certainly made regulated by just one transcription factor, but you have quite a number of genes here that are in fact regulated by several factors, and you can imagine that this kind of combinatorial control is going on also in here. So what do we do practically to address this problem? Well, what we do is the following.
Can we stop you for a minute?
Yeah, questions. Sure.
Go ahead. So the competition you refer to, is that actually literally competition? So for example, obviously if you're looking at chromatin immunoprecipitation, as you've shown there, if there truly is competition, then you'll underestimate the number of binding factors there are here, because of course there are different regulatory states. But are these actually competitions at the DNA level, or is it just competing inputs, positive versus negative?
No, I guess they're really competing. I mean, the way I see the process, I mean, there's no model which has been written down. But the way I understand this nonlinear competition here is that imagine you have a certain concentration of bicoid and a certain concentration of giant, for example. And then you have a certain affinity here of giant and bicoid for the same site here. Then you just estimate this exponential, you know, let's estimate that it's a Boltzmann distribution in the first approximation. You don't say that it's Fermi-Dirac. Let's take Boltzmann in first approximation. So it's, you know, you're going to have that the probability that bicoid is going to bind here is the concentration of bicoid time exponential of minus beta epsilon.
Okay, the competition need not be at the level of DNA, and certainly in some cases it's not. So it can be competition between recruitment of repressors and activators, and the steady state competition of the steady state concentration of activating elements versus recruiting, or activating components versus repressing components. So I guess the competition need not be at the level of DNA.
When you say recruitment, you mean
recruitment of co-activators and co-repressors.
Okay, fine. Yes, there might be an additional level of regulation which is made of cofactors. Certainly, I'm just saying that this kind of effect here might provide you already a level of regulation, which might then be supplemented by the fact that the protein is binding and there's a cofactor coming in or not coming in. That's what you mean.
But the statement here is that these sites are really overlapped.
Yes.
So
yes.
We know that there should be some steric
That's
interaction.
Right.
So is that true? Has that actually been shown experimentally that there really is steric hindrance of binding of the factors in those sites that are close to each other?
So maybe I have a somewhat simpler and related question. So these sites are predicted sites?
No.
Or sites known?
No. These are sites known from footprinting. Every time what you do is that you put one protein and you do the footprinting. So that's why competition, because in this experiment what you do is...
This is done in vivo or
this is
in
done.
Vitro?
This is done, I guess, in vitro. This is done in vitro.
And some of them then are confirmed by genetics, mutagenesis done on particular sites that has phenotype. I guess the question is,
there's
one agglomeration of sites. How many are redundant and how many are...
Most of them are redundant, in fact. And that's one of the problems. You know, you cannot just... If you knock out one of them, nothing happens. And that's one of the reasons why you cannot just go and spot one binding site. As I was saying, I mean, those are weak, by the way. Most of them are weak. So if you take one out, then nothing really happens. And when you look at the evolution of those modules, you will see that most of them, in fact, disappear. You know, if you compare the two species, Drosophila and Melanogaster and Pseudoscura, most of them will just disappear or will change the affinity, and the model is still working perfectly fine.
But what is the state of experimental models there? So is there some sort of systematic study that gone after these decoyed sites and knocked out B1, B1 and B2, and B1, B2, B3?
Not that I know. Maybe somebody has done that and he hasn't published, but published, I haven't seen any really systematic thing.
But
working
out. Could, in principle, make a whole bunch of reporters...
One could.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Experimental on the steric side, that's the same. I haven't seen any experiment on steric.
Because very often it's true, so in our system, which
right. would be fair I've seen that.
In fact, there is not a steric hindrance at all. It's really just recruitment of co-repressors and co-activators, and the competition is the information being signaled to the basal transcription apparatus, sort of reaching a threshold for either activation or repression.
But you have the same picture as here, where you have...
In some cases, they're close. I don't know how... So the problem is, because of the redundancy, we don't know for sure that a Bitcoin site overlaps with a Krupal site.
Mm-hmm.
The sites overlap, but do they actually, does that B5 site actually, for example, really get used? And if you look at the overlaps there, it's only with redundant factors, right?
Yes. Well, they're all redundant, in fact. All of them have multiple binding sites. That's the problem. I mean, that's why it's not obvious to draw conclusion. I mean, but that's the impression you have, is that this, at least visually, it's kind of... Now, quantitatively, I wouldn't put my hand on that this is crucial.
Yeah, precisely for
precisely for this reason.
Redundancy, so it hasn't been a clear-cut case of one redundant.
Yes, absolutely.
So there still has to be some issue of threshold achieved between and competition between a positive input and a negative input after factors have bound.
Yes.
Because there aren't complete exclusion, steric exclusion of factors.
I mean, even once you've bound the factor, then the dynamics, the resulting dynamics is also quite non-trivial and non-linear, certainly, yes. In fact, we don't even know in this problem the response function. You know, you might say, okay, let's say that we know the binding sites here, and now we want to write, for example, an Hamiltonian here saying, you know, you have the occupation number here, 01, and you want to write an Hamiltonian saying what's the response of the system once you have the population here. But this is kind of a very large problem, and there's no information whatsoever on this kind of thing. That's the thing that one would like to do, to model this, for example, to write down this kind of thing, but there's not enough information. Yes?
Now, the terrible thing about this seminar is that you can might assume that people in this room know what you know, fly embryo is, more than they know the homophonium.
Then I saw.
So you have to explain everything.
So what do we do for this? As I was saying, we cannot just use standard tools, bioinformatic tools, because they're not really well adapted for this because of the weakness of the binding sites, because they tend to spot one strong binding site, one pattern. And in fact, we want to have an aggregation of binding sites, possibly weak. So what we are looking after is essentially this, is essentially an aggregation of binding sites. And we are trying, and we want, I mean, we don't know whether it's crucial or not, but you know, in principle, we want to take into account these overlapping binding sites. So we don't want just a normal Viterbi kind algorithm, which is just taking the maximum into account. So what we do is this. I mean, we just take, imagine you're given as input a list of transcription factors, like for example for the fly, we will take, as you will see in a second, we'll take Bicoid, Hunchback, Giant, Cruple, and all the factors that you've seen on top of the hierarchy. And you take a model for the background, you can, you know, it's not very important. Here for the fly we have taken a Markov chain, but that's not very important. So you have a model of the background telling you in the rest of the genome what is the statistics of the nucleotides. And then what you want, and then you're given a sequence, a genomic sequence, like for example 500 bases. So the purpose of all this is that we want to take a window of a few hundred bases, have an estimate of how important the binding sites in this region are, how many you have, and what's the can have an estimate of how many and how strong the binding sites are, then estimate, get this number, slide the window over the whole genome, and pick the places where there's an aggregation of these binding sites. So that's the purpose of all this I'm going to tell you in a second. So what we do is that we have a list of weight matrices, so the affinities essentially for the transcription factors. So what we do now is that we take the sequences, those few 500 bases. So what we do is that we start putting down one of the choosing one of the transcription factor, with each transcription factor has a certain probability of being drawn. So we put down one, and we cover this part of the sequence of length L1 of the transcription factor. Then we choose another one, and then we go on piling the sequence until we get to the end. So what's the probability of this particular tiling here? Well, the probability is just the product over all the bricks, over all the tiles that I put down, so this is the probability. And then there's the match between the subsequence here and the transcription and the affinity matrix, which is here, which can be factorized as products over all the positions. So that's the probability for one particular tiling. Now, if you want to have the superposition, that would be Viterbi. So it would say I would pick the location where the affinity is maximum. Okay, for each particular subsequence here, I would pick the transcription factor which is has the most affinity for this. That would be kind of a Viterbi style algorithm. In fact, we don't want that because we want to have the overlaps. So what we do is that we just take what in, again, the partition function of the tilings here, so we sum up over all possible tilings which are here. And of course the number of possible tilings of a sequence of length L is exponential in L. So there's a problem of computation here, but what you might remark is that in fact this is a one-dimensional problem of a finite range of interaction, it's the length of the sequence. So you can just use what in statistical physics is called transfer matrix method, and in computer science is called dynamic programming. You can just calculate up to a point and then move ahead. So in fact you can calculate all this and derivatives in a linear time. So the problem is easily solved and computed, and then you optimize over the probabilities of the transcription factors, maximizing the likelihood to observe the sequence. So once you do all this, at the end of it, it takes a linear time, so in fact you can, as I was saying, compute everything for the genome of the fly in like in less than a day on a PC. And then, so the quantity which is of interest here is how important are the binding sites and how strong they are. So what you want is that you want a quantity which scales linearly in the length. So you want what is called an extensive quantity. So you take the log of the partition function. But you also want to subtract the contribution which is coming just from the background, because it might be a region that is quite differing from the background, the genomic background. So in that case, you want to take the contribution out. So you just take the difference between the two logs. And that's the score that you compute. So how does it work, all this? So let's take one region which is quite well known, which is HERI, which is a Peru gene. This is the where the gene is. And these regions here are the known models. So what you see here, and this is our score here, the R that I've shown you before. So as you can see, the peaks are indeed at the right location, and we get essentially all of them, with the exception of this guy here. The exception of this guy here, it's interesting because it's the only parameter that we have left. The only parameter is that, so what we've done is that we have taken a window and we are sliding the window of, we have taken 500 bases, okay? So we have taken a sequence of 500 bases. We calculate the score here, 250 in this direction, 250 in this direction. So, and why do we miss this? The reason we miss this is that, as you can see from the span of this region here, this region is quite more extended than 500 bases. So what happens, in fact, is that the binding sites are important in here, but since we have taken a window of 500 bases, in fact, we miss this module here. Because, yeah.
So there are these bars, colored bars,
of particular. Right, color bars are, okay, so these are the transcription factors that we use for spotting this sequence. So we have taken essentially the maternal and the gap transcription factors. So we input all this list of transcription factors into the algorithm. We calculate the score and we move along the genome. And these are binding sites for the various factors. So for example, this one here are binding sites for talus, this one are for knirps, this one are for dorsal, this one for beta.
Wait, so why are there no bars over that region that we missed?
This one?
Yeah.
This? Because we just put in the bars in the regions that we predicted.
And the prediction was based on some threshold?
The prediction was based on a threshold that we set from the known binding sites. From the known modules. So there was a list of about 15 modules. So we run our algorithm here over the known modules, and you find a certain number of scores, and you fix the minimum of them as the threshold.
So the vertical axis is
is the score.
Is the logarithm of
Z minus log of Z. So it's the score R, which is here. This, the free energy. Yes.
So suppose that you would put the bars everywhere where the binding site occurs.
Right.
Would it be possible just by visualizing the bar sequence to recognize these areas?
Yes, they would be much more dense in this region here. Just visually you would see there's an aggregation. I mean, that's essentially what the algorithm is doing, is spotting aggregation of binding sites. So you would see visually, it would strike you as being more dense.
But I guess the problem is that if you set the threshold so that you detect that extended block that you missed,
right,
you also predict another block.
Absolutely.
Over there to
the right. Yes. So the fix to the problem is not to lower the threshold, in fact. It's to increase the window size. Okay. So that's what in fact one should do. One should increase the window size. So this way the density of binding sites, you see the problem is that you have a certain density of binding sites. If you increase the size of the window you're using to scan the thing, then you would get this one as well.
But then I have a problem. If you do that to get the one that you missed, you also...
Then I will miss some other ones, yes.
Not miss, then you'll start having the false positive. Or is that train of sites conceivably functional as well?
No, this train of sites, in fact, is not a linear function. You cannot guess easily from here, from the score here, what the score is going to be if you take a larger window. That's not a linear function. So in fact, it's really, you know, you have to compute because there's the minimization problem which is going on, and there's the density of binding size. So once you increase...
The threshold is not just averaging what you got here.
No.
The threshold will really change your Z.
Yes. Well, no, in fact, the threshold for this given, you know, what we did is that you have this parameter. So either you make an algorithm that changes the window size, that's something which is doable, but that's not what we've done. What we've done is that we fix one length, 500 bases, okay? We run with the 500 bases over known modules, and we get the score, a number of scores, and we pick the minimum, okay? And we set the threshold there. And whatever we get higher, if this one we missed, okay? Okay, too bad, we missed it. We're gonna come up with a list of predictions and we'll see what comes out. There are certainly false negatives. There's much more modules than what we predicted. I mean, we predicted 100, but said certainly more. That's clear. Okay, so let's see how it works. I mean, so the experiment to be done is to take the predictions, make a reporter gene construct with those few 500 bases, and to see whether the reporter gene is giving an expression which is part of the endogenous expression profile. And that's what you get here. Okay? You see that these are all positive cases, and Ulrike Gaul and her group, they have done the experiment on 19 cases, and they came up with positive results on 13 out of 19. So that's the kind of success rate that we have. In fact, it's even, I find even more interesting the few cases where it doesn't work. The few cases where it doesn't work, it's interesting because these are three cases where it doesn't work. Okay? So that's a module that we predicted was stuck into the reporter gene, and that's the expression that you get. Okay? So it has nothing to do with the endogenous expression, but you see that in fact the module is responding. So it's driving an expression, but it's a completely promiscuous expression like this one. So what is probably going on, I mean, it's not known, we don't know what is going on, but most probably what is happening is that there must be some kind of silencer or chromatin modification that are kind of shutting down the expression of those genes here. That's the most immediate way of cutting down this promiscuous expression here. So there must be kind of chromatin remodeling which is going on.
What is your recipient reporter in these experiments? So what's the context of that you're testing the module within? Because some of the negatives may be the result of communication between other modules you haven't identified, right?
Well, that's one thing that always bothers me when I talk about modules. I'm not quite convinced that those modules are modules.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much convinced that in fact that's just the zeroth order, and then they kind of talk to each other.
Right.
With silences, with other kind of things. So, in fact, it might well be due to communication between modules.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you stick to modules, there shouldn't be this kind of effects. But I agree, I mean, I don't think those are
so
perfect.
You don't want to call these false negatives, really, because...
They respond. I mean, they respond to the transcription. And there's something else, which is... That's why I'm saying it's even more interesting, because even the six that do not work, they kind of respond this way. So in fact, they are responding. The binding sites are there, they are responding. There's something else which is controlling the process and the dynamics. Okay, so this is just a parenthesis to show that... I mean, we've been talking about eukaryotes, but in fact, similar processes might be going on in bacteria as well, which is kind of surprising because usually in bacteria one says that the binding sites are much more specific. There's at least one particular example where these kind of arguments have turned out to work pretty well, and that's the example I've been investigating, which is this factor called air, control of virulence. It's the response element of a two-component system, which is here. That's a sketch of a two-component system. So there's the sensor which gets a signal from the environment, phosphorylates this receptor, this regulatory protein here, that then acts on DNA, regulating the transcription. So the R here stands for the regulator. Here. Now, when you do footprinting experiments in this Streptococcus agalactiae, what you find out is this kind. So the region shadowed here are the regions which are covered by the protein. Now, if you try to look at these regions here and you try to find out the consensus sequence, there's no way you can come up with a consensus sequence. And the other thing which is interesting is that, in fact, you have multiple binding sites, again, in all these regions. So the idea is that, in fact, the specificity of this factor might, in fact, be coming not from the affinity, from a specific, but it's, again, it might be due to kind of this process of multiple binding sites going on. And so what we decided was to try to see if something, well, of course, once you do the microarray, what you find out is that this this signal is controlling plenty of things. This is three growth times. This is the beginning of the growth time, the middle, and the end stationary. And this is the number of proteins that respond to this protein. And as usual, when you do a microarray, you have the problem what's it's controlled directly by the protein, what is indirect, and all the hierarchy. So we just decided to apply the same algorithm, and this is what comes out. So without knowing the binding site, just take three of the genes which are controlled, then you construct the weight matrix, and then you scan the rest of the genome looking for aggregation of binding sites of this factor, and this is what you get. So in red are genes which are responding to the transcript that you see changing their expression profile on the macroarray. So in fact, out of 14, 10 respond, and in fact, that's a good prediction. And again, the interesting point is the four which are not working. The four that are not working, in fact, it's even more interesting because they are located in pathogenicity islands. Pathogenicity islands, meaning that they're most probably, they are indeed controlled by a factor like this. The phenotype of this factor here is that it reduces the virulence of the bacterium. So if you knock out this gene, what happens is that the virulence of the bacterium goes up. So it is very likely that, in fact, you have this, you have control even in this region here, but there's multiple control. So there are several factors that are controlling this guy here, and the single knockout of just COV-R is not enough to change the expression level of these genes here. So the picture, from an evolutionary point of view, the picture is kind of this. You have COV-R, which is sticking to regions which are inserted into the genome. You have these horizontally transferred regions. And what you have is that this COV-R is binding to those regions, keeping them controlled in such a way that they don't mess up the virulence of the bacterium. And then it gives time to the bacterium to kind of establish a genetic network to put them under a more stable and sophisticated control. So that's the scheme which is more or less coming out. It's very schematic. That's just the gene that you get. Now, this brings me to the problem of how all these modules are evolving. Because in fact, the problem is that what we have been doing up to now is to looking at one arrow here. So all the modules and all the things that we have seen is one arrow here. Okay. And now this is the whole network, regulatory network, which is made of many modules, like the one I've discussed, which has been worked out by the group of Eric Davidson, and it's in sea urchin, and it's the genetic network which is responsible for the differentiation between endoderm and mesoderm. So that's the whole network, and one should see all the modules within this. Yes.
Module is one arrow, or this little block of arrows?
In fact, this one would be, for example, that this gene here is regulating this one. So the modules would be.
But that could be just a binding site.
That could be one, but in fact, all of them tend to be modules of regulation.
Wait, but the modules combine many different
binding sites,
many different factors.
Right.
So I'd say that the module would be more like a horizontal bar with many inputs and with some activators and repressors.
Right. Right. So, no, but I mean, what I mean is that we are talking about many. Okay, fine. No, I understand your point. Right. So this guy here would be a module.
Okay. It's actually multiple modules. So a given arrow can mean any different module.
Right. So all this is kind of, you know, we've been looking at just this little thing here. In fact, the whole picture and the whole process and the whole selection which is going on is at this level here. Because in fact, what we care about is the function. I mean, we want to differentiate endoderm from mesoderm, and we don't really care about one of them. We care about the final result and the function, which is the differentiation. Now, this is kind of interesting because it points to an evolution, an evolutive mechanism that are quite different from the usual picture that one has in mind of very simply moving binding sites up and down. And it's a very nice experiment where they've shown, in fact, that there's a strong coevolutive dynamics going on in these models. This is experiment was made by Ludwig et al. What they've done is a very, very pretty experiment where they've taken two species of Drosophila, Melanogaster and Pseudoscura. And these are the wild-type expression patterns here. So essentially it's conserved. The pattern of expression is well conserved. And what they've done is that, well, they've sequenced the region of EVE2 here. That's the region of EVE2. And now what they've done is that they've looked at the binding sites for the various factors that were identified, and they compare what they get in Melanogaster and what they get in Pseudoscura. And the upshot of all this is that when you look in detail, in fact, there's not much conservation which is going on. You don't conserve single binding sites. If you just compare the sequence and you blast them, you wouldn't see much more conservation than in other regions. The other thing that you have is that you have new binding sites coming up, like this one, for example, that was completely absent in Melanogaster. But still, what happens is now you make the experiment where you take the region of Melanogaster and you stick in Pseudoscura, trying to see if it is able to drive the pattern of Pseudoscura. And what happens is that everything works fine. Okay? Like here, what you have is that you exchange the two and you get something which is like the wild type of the two species. So even though the details of all the binding sites and the other things are changed, the final result for this model is that you exchange the two models and it's still working. But you can do quite anything you want, because then you have the control. They've made this experiment where you take half of Melanogaster and half of Pseudoscura, you construct this module, and you stick it in, and what you see is that the expression pattern goes wrong. So it doesn't drive any longer. Meaning that there's a coevolutive pressure which is going on. You have half of it controlled with the other half, so the whole thing is selected, but you can have many mutations and many changes in each one of the elements and keep the whole thing working. So that's the typical coevolutive patterns that you have. Now I'm short of time, so I think I'm gonna skip the rest and just tell you what happens. Now the same idea of coevolutive, it's quite a general idea. You might test. It's very hard to test it here because you should know the affinities, you should know the binding sites, you should know all the affinities. So it's quite hard to test it quantitatively here. But you might kind of inspire yourself from this idea of coevolutive, of many elements in a module which are evolving in a coevolutive way. So the next thing where you have many data and you might try to check if it's working are protein complexes in yeast. So what we did is that we essentially looked in protein complexes and we tried to see if these same kind of effects could be quantified. And one could check, for example, how much evolutive pressure is going on at the level of pairs of protein or triplets of protein or four proteins interacting together, and to see if the coevolutive pressure is just at the level of pairs or it's going on at the level of triplets or four protein interacting. And the result is that, in fact, you indeed get a lot of coevolutive pressure here. You can check at the, just, you know, just to give you a play of what is done, you get the pictures and you control what, you know, you make a comparative analysis of Cerevisiae with respect to four other yeasts, and you look at the evolution rates, and you want to know whether proteins which are interacting, they tend to have evolutive rates which are closer when they are interacting than when they are not. And then you look at the, yes?
Sorry, I think you went a little
too fast
here.
Yes.
So, first of all, how do you define this evolutionary pressure? Then, did you just switch from talking about regulatory regions to
yes. Right. So I switched because regulatory region, that's about what I can say, because then to make a model, to look at the evolutive pressure here, I will need to know what's the affinity of all these factors here for all this DNA. So it's not just an evolution which is going on at the level of DNA, it's something which also goes on, you might have the transcription factor which is changing affinity.
More preliminary question.
Yes.
Just comparing these regions, do you see that they're completely randomized except
no.
for the binding sites, or there's the largest chunks that are conserved which include the binding sites and
no, in fact what you see is that
in between,
in fact what you see is that when you compare the sequences here, you wouldn't be able just on the basis of sequence comparison to infer the modules. Because there's a lot of changes which are going on in the modules. So what you can do is that you might...
How is it done? But you can assume that the Kupo and Knorr's binding sites or weight matrices are unchanged between the two species?
This is what is suggested by this experiment here. In principle, it's not known. It is surmised from this experiment that since when you exchange the two modules, it's still working, you surmise that they have the same
effect. If you run your algorithm
yes.
With Grzhoff,
doesn't work.
With non-Gaussian weight matrices in
yes.
pseudoscura,
yeah.
You pick up the pseudoscura module, or
you
say
do.
That you don't?
Well, you do. But you don't conserve, what I'm trying to say is that you don't conserve the architecture within the module of the binding site. You tend to lose this and still preserve the function.
But you lose the architecture, but are you saying that you preserve patches of sequence better than you preserve the architecture?
No.
Right, this is the question of what's the local conservation and global conservation.
Right?
We can imagine a global conservation that architecture is conserved, but there are high density of point substitutions.
Yeah,
or we can imagine that point-wise it is well conserved, except for some gaps, inversions, permutations,
no.
etc.
There are binding sites that are coming up that were not in melanogaster, and there are binding sites that are lost. So you don't.
But point-wise, there are larger segments that are completely conserved. And what I'm trying to understand
yes.
is whether this rearrangement
yeah.
is just plausibly driven by local mutations, right? Local
yes.
substitutions.
Yes.
Or
that's kind of what you get here. Or
so
but they also move around. You want to know whether it's preserved the distance, for example, from the gene?
Well, I'm trying to understand whether the evolution is driven by point substitutions or by duplications and deletions of chunks of sequence.
Well, look, I mean, look here. You have quite a few deletions here. And that's quite representative of what you have. So you have quite a few deletions. You have a few binding sites that are going up. That's what you have. This one is very well preserved. This one, for example, is not very well preserved here.
Well, I guess I'm fishing basically for the comparison of two numbers. If we look at the percent amount, you do some alignment with gaps.
Okay.
Right? And then you ask what fraction of the sequence is in indels, right? What fraction of the sequence has fallen into the gap?
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say it's 27%.
Okay.
And then you can ask what fraction of the remaining aligned sequence got substituted. And and the question is it 2% or is it 30% or is it 80%? You know, can one by looking at it? And of course, there's a question of exactly how you do alignment and whatever your email penalty. But can one arrive at some notion that this evolution is proceeding? You know, indels
are sort of
consistent with
the
substitution.
No, I don't know the answer.
So, I didn't understand why you argued that you're expecting that there's going to be changes in affinity at the protein level, and that means it makes it very difficult to create a model, because...
No, I'm just saying that you might have... Well, it's known
here
that...
Here it's not the case, right? It's obscure in the gas, but there aren't relevant changes in affinity.
In the proteins?
Yeah.
No, because when you compare the sequences, indeed, they look... The bindings, the amino acids that are making contact with DNA were conserved.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it is changing. I'm just saying that in principle you might imagine that you change the affinities as well. But not here. I mean, here the evidence is that it's not, that the affinity is preserved. But I'm saying in the general case, arguing, you know, on the evolution of those guys, you might evolve the whole system by changing the affinity of the transcription factor,
yes,
a priori. Now, in this case, it doesn't seem to be the case. But still, you know, arguing on the evolution of this system is quite complicated, because then you should write down what is missing, saying the response, the response. Because what you want is after all, what would you do if you had to write down an evolutive model for this? You would need to know what happens to the fitness and to the response of this module if I change, for example, this binding site. That's what I will need, because that's what would drive the evolution of the system. And in the absence of this, there's not much we can do other than aligning the sequence, which to me is not very meaningful, because once you have the affinity, as you were saying, the transcription factor, they bind, and then, what's the expression? I mean, once they're bound, what's the expression? And this information is missing, so we cannot really write down a dynamics and evolutive dynamics for this system. So that's why kind of for proteins it's more clear that they stick together. But I guess that's yes.
We go back to this question of redundancy, yes,
right,
and some kind of comprehensive and systematic study of reporters with different constructs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, admittedly. Well, one needs more data, mm-hmm, and sort of sequencing, looking at different flies is a good way of getting some of the sequences.
Sure.
But conceivably, one can sort of start splicing and deleting these promoters in vitro and putting them back together and.
Mm-hmm.
Accumulate some larger database,
mm-hmm,
of the things that work,
mm-hmm,
and do not work.
Right, that would be, you would put the dynamic 0-1 rather than, and then you might say, okay, this, you might put the dynamic 0-1, right? That would be certainly a first step, but not even this is known, so it's kind of very hard to add. The only thing, you just look at the sequence and clearly it's not quite like bacteria where you preserve the binding site and you're happy. If the binding site is gone, regulation is gone. If you lose a binding site, if you keep the binding site, then regulation is there. That really looks like...
But this basically sort of says that there's more than one solution to the problem, but not
yes,
a single solution. Right?
That's right, exactly. That's what he's saying. And now there's the problem of how you go from one basin to the other basin. That's the problem. How can you go from one basin to the other basin? That's the problem. But you need data. So I think I'm going to stop there. And that's the people I've been working with. Ulrike Gaul has been doing the experiment on the fly. Eric Ziger, Nikolaus Fajewski, where Nikolaus being now at New York University. Glazem, Zadek, Trioko are the people in Pasteur on the bacterium, and then Dujon and Vespignani are the people I've worked with on the proteins that I've not discussed in details.
Well, I'm trying to get them all out. So basically the conclusion is that if you make small perturbations in these
That's part of it. In fact, I would say that the system is even more capable of bearing fluctuations. Because in fact, what happens, imagine the following experiments that was discussed the other time. You lower the temperature from 25 to 15 degrees. Okay. Then from this whole picture, you would say, as a physicist, the fly cannot make it. Because the affinities are fixed. The probability to bind is exponential minus beta epsilon. So you would say all the probabilities are completely changed, they are changed, certainly. Then you completely change the combinatorics and it's not going to work. In fact, what happens is that it's working perfectly fine and it's just taking twice the same time. So there's even more in the sea. It's not just small fluctuations that are able. And even more, there's more symmetry in the system. There's another experiment which has been made by Ousmane Dassé and collaborators. What they've done is that you take the embryos, the mother can make smaller or bigger embryos. So what you do is that you change the size of the embryo, okay? Because of fluctuations, because we are not all the same size. And now, you've seen that the morphogens are injected with the typical length scale because that's the exponential that was defined. And now what you see, but at the end of the day, you have to have a rescaling with the size of the embryo because you want to have your appendages and your segment rescaling with the size of the embryo. So in addition to all the other things that the system has to do, there must be also this kind of robustness with respect to temperature and other things. Now, there might be checkpoints, and then the system might be much easier to deal with. You have a checkpoint, you don't go on until the other things are done. So this slowing down might, in fact, be due to checkpoints, but that's an open question.
Going back to this predictive modules and mm-hmm. the ones that work and the ones that don't work, you have many different transcription factors that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Did you check if there is any correlation between the occurrence of certain transcription factors and bad predictions?
Right, that's what Eric CG and company did. So what they've done is that they've tried to correlate the, you have these pictures of the binding sites. Like for example here. So you have a certain density of you have a certain density of binding sites, and you want to know from the density of binding sites of different factors if this module is going to drive the expression of an anterior, a posterior, a central module, and so on. So from this, try to guess if it's going to be anterior, posterior, or other things, and it works. It works pretty well.
So wait, I think you're answering
another question.
Different question. Right. One could then conceivably try to predict more, given that you can predict the module.
Yes.
You can try to predict where it will be expressed.
That's right.
But I'm asking a slightly different question. Somewhat related to Joel's question before.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, if I understand correctly, all the weight matrices, all mm-hmm. the transcription factors, are treated democratically. They're all equal.
Right.
But suppose one of them happens to be involved in chromatin remodeling. And another one just interacts with, recruits the polymerase. Now, they can have very different role,
mm-hmm.
and, some of them may, like to cluster more, others less. Clustering of one can be sort of more significant of a module than the other. So then the question is, just by looking at when your predictions fail,
mm-hmm.
can you see some bias in...
Distinguish
between the factors.
that have seen it's not
clustering obvious. Are more predictable than modules.
Yeah, no, I understand. From those that have seen, from the six that I've seen, which do not work, I can go there. One thing that we have been thinking with Nikolaos was to try to implement the concentrations. No, rather than maximizing the partition function, maximize the probability, knowing the concentration at a certain point, you put in the imagine you knew the concentrations, more or less, then rather than maximizing just the sticking here, you would maximize the probability with the concentration that combines there. But we discussed this at length, but we didn't have the concentrations. But that's doable. In principle, it's doable. And I guess it's gonna reduce the force, the number. It's gonna certainly be more specific at a certain region, but it's gonna be better. Now from the six that do not work, I can see I don't recall any particular concentration or any particular factor being implicated in those that do not work. But that's I may check out again because I just looked at that.
Okay.